Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Giustina. Joining us this week is State Assembly Member Sarah Hanna Shrestha, Democratic Socialist, who represents the 103rd District in New York State. The district includes, but is not limited to, Kingston, Woodstock, Red Hook, and New Paltz. Assembly Member Sarah Hanna Shrestha, welcome to the Capital Connection.
Thank you. Very excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here. I began to research and look at what you've done, not only in your legislative career so far, but where you're from. And I see that you were born and raised in Kathmandu. You have quite an interesting story to tell about how you came to this country and eventually your path leading to wanting to ultimately become a lawmaker. Can you give us a bit of an understanding of how you got to this point in your life?
Sure. So for those who don't know where Nepal is, it's between Tibet and India. We're a little sandwiched, landlocked country, tiny country with a giant diversity of languages, of ethnicities. And I was born in Kathmandu to very young parents. And one of the things that informed my political formation is that we did not have democracy until I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I got to witness the successful uprising for democracy as a child. You know, one of the vivid memories I have is being stuck in a school bus because there were altercations happening outside between protesters and the police. And, you know, some of my schoolmates witnessed violent things. Some of our family friends' grandfather, you know, was one of the leaders who was basically killed for fighting for democracy. So it was not optional for me to be apolitical. You know, that was not an option. And then the other vivid memory I have is when the royal family did agree to being just ceremonial and allowing democracy in the country. There was a really, you know, inspiring parade that went outside our house. And at the forefront of that parade was this young woman who was, you know, must have been 24, 23. And she was really, really ecstatic about this new beginning for the country. And then shortly after that, we had a civil war that started that recruited a lot of extremely poor people across the country who had so far been isolated. And the premise was this new democracy was going to be a half measure for the rest, you know, for most of the country. And it turned out to be a 10-year long civil war that was quite violent. It was, you know, primarily between the army and the civil army. Lots of people lost their lives, but it completely transformed the country. There's no return point after something like that happens. And what I saw during that time was, one, what people can be driven to do when they have been so isolated and so neglected for the longest time. A prominent feature of this time was there were many villages that had never been connected to the rest of the country because they didn't have roads. And one of the things you could see changing was there was a road being built by the Maoists using a forced labor from each family. And, you know, there were even some children building, working on these roads and driving across the country, because I did go to the most rural part of the country where this war started with some journalists. And one thing you could see was the transformation that was happening in parts of the country wherever the road was coming. And that was such a real visual of change happening, you know, as you're driving across the country. And, you know, that's really what shaped my politics, that we cannot neglect public good. We cannot assume that we can forever isolate people. It's not avoidable. We have to bring everybody in. We had people who did not have hospitals, who died on their way to hospitals because they had to wait for 3 days to get care. And this was a common story. And, you know, this is not one country's story. Basically, all of the people all over the country want the same things. They want stable housing. They want to be healthy. They want to spend time with their family and they want a good job. That's what everybody wants.
And you come at it from the democratic socialism perspective,
yes,
which I think takes a harder look at capitalism and its exploitation of labor and some of these other things. And you'd like to see a fairer balance come out of that mix. Am I accurate in describing your philosophy?
Yes. You know, as democratic socialists, one of the problems that we identify is that capitalism is actually not sustainable if we want an economy that works for everyone, because it depends on continued exploitation. It depends on continued division amongst the working class. It continues because of extraction that has to happen. Of, you know, our planetary resources. When it cannot extract in one place, it will find another place, and that frontier of exploitation keeps moving, and it does not acknowledge the boundaries of the planet as well as of humans and, you know, our relationship with the planet and each other. So we want an economy that is not designed around profits, the infinite drive of profits. We want an economy that is designed around our collective well-being, and we want workers who keep our economy running to be able to reap the benefits of the labor they've put in, because right now they're completely sidelined, especially coming out of the pandemic.
We're speaking with Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha. She's a Democratic Socialist representing the 103rd District in New York State, and you are listening to The Capital Connection. I'm David Gustina. Well, it seems like we continue this back and forth, this pendulum that swings between the I and individualism in the capitalist society,
yes,
to the we and the demos, the democracy part,
yeah,
of it. And how do you get so many Americans who identify with the perhaps one of the number one values in this country, which is money and greed, and I'm going to get mine, and, you know, social Darwinism? How do we convince a good part of this country right now that is going in the opposite direction?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons democratic socialism sort of saw a revival is because we do have a generation of people who are my age or younger who see the limits of the I, and who see that when we talk about the I, there are lots of people who are getting left behind, and it just happens to be us. You know, so for my generation, and especially younger than me, it is really out of reach to be a first-time home buyer. In our area in the Hudson Valley, fixer-uppers are not cheap. They're still expensive. And it's not easy to fix anything, especially in the context of labor shortages, supply chain issues. It's all of the things that we took for granted even 20 years ago have become much more difficult to attain. And we also see the people who benefit from a fracture amongst the bottom 90%, let's say, are corporations, are the big CEOs. And it is strategic for us to be united against those big, powerful forces, because our only strength is in numbers. We're not going to be able to have more money than them. We're not going to, you know, have inside political power that's bigger than theirs. But together, as a group of people, like you said, the demos, the 90%, they will never have that number. So what can we do when we come together on these issues? And, you know, one of the things that is happening at the state level is, you know, unions and all these different organizations are coming around together on the issue of taxing the very ultra rich, for example, because we know that when we are told we don't have money for the things that we need, what we're actually saying is we don't want to collect the $40 billion of revenues that is there. We just don't want to touch it because it belongs to the 1%.
We are in a place now where so many lawmakers are recognizing the crunch here with housing and affordable housing. Even,
yes,
the governor of the state, Kathy Hochul, tried last session to push, what, another 800,000 housing units in her proposal. That didn't go so well because you've got local zoning issues. So how do you see this session? Do we come up with a proposal that works? Are we going to be able to help some of the folks that you're talking about in your district and elsewhere across the state with the affordability of their rent? I can remember not so long ago a candidate who ran out of New York City who ran on the campaign, the rent is too damn high,
yes,
and it still is.
Yes. So, you know, what does it look like at the ground level in our district? We don't have fire volunteers because they can't afford to live there anymore. you know, this is a common story. We don't have children being able to live close to their parents who are now grandparents because they can't afford to live close to their parents. So there is a domino effect of displacement happening. If you lose your lease in Kingston, you're probably out of luck. You're probably going to have to, move to Newburgh. And then Newburgh is going to start feeling that pressure. Then you're going to have to go somewhere else, you know? So the main thing that we want to push in whatever housing deal that we come up with is, what are we going to do about people who need to remain housed, right? Who need to remain housed, who are on the verge of maybe losing their lease. So we're fighting for a strong version of good cause eviction, because right now in housing court, a tenant does not have a line of defense. You can be a great tenant. You can be paying your rent, month after month. You could even be paying early, but that's not going to stop some of the landlords from ending your lease, because either you can rent to another family that's moving with more money. They have more money to dispense. Or you can just convert it into a short-term rental. And both of these things are happening in my district in 103rd, not just in the city of Kingston, but in places like Rosendale, which are more suburban, more rural. So in the Hudson Valley, 55% of tenants are rent burdened, which means they spend more than a third of their income on housing. And anecdotally, most people I've met actually are spending closer to 50% or even more than 50%. So that's a problem, because that has not stopped landlords from raising the rent and using higher rent as a reason to evict these tenants. So one main thing we want to make sure is, when we pass good cause eviction, we're not making it an opt-in for municipalities, because the truth is, even if every major city in the Hudson Valley opted in, let's say City of Kingston, let's say, Village of New Paltz, even if these major places opted in, it would still leave out about 60% of the tenants, and that's roughly 177,000 households, so it's a lot of people. But I do want to flag that we cannot take it for granted even that places like the Village of New Paltz will be able to opt in, despite being very progressive, because the truth is they have not been able to pass a good cause law because the landlords there are very aggressive, and you're dealing with vulnerable village board members who are getting terrorized by some of these aggressive...
And I imagine a high student renting population as well, because it's New Paltz.
Yes, exactly. And then in Ulster County is one of the more progressive upstate counties. It has not been able to pass a local good cause because many people on the legislature are landlord themselves and they recuse themselves. So if we are leaving it to municipalities and local governments to opt in, it's not going to have the intended effect. So one of the main things that we are pushing for is, we need this bill to have its effect. It's going to allow landlords to negotiate rent increases directly with the tenants. That's not being stopped. It's just that if they are increasing it beyond a certain level, they have to justify it in court.
And how much was this an unintended consequence of the pandemic? In other words, landlords were not allowed to raise the rent. We had put rules, strict rules on that. And it seems like now that the pandemic, fingers crossed, is over, that they've gone swiftly to raise the cost of those rents to get to where they would have been before the pandemic.
I actually think what we are seeing right now is just the logical continuation of looking at homes as investment properties. I think even without the pandemic, we would see this course. And that's because a lot of folks think of housing as a way to generate income, which, touches on a larger problem, which is, why should that be a source of income? But in some cases, it is by need as well, for seniors in my district, for example. But we cannot pit that against other people's right to be homed. And we think this bill is a fair balance, because it's not going to limit good landlords who have good relationship with their tenants and who are not evicting tenants for no good cause, right, for no good reason. It's only going to target landlords who are exploiting the situation to just keep increasing those rents. And the numbers of the rise in evictions that we are seeing that don't have anything to do with non-payment is increasing. And we see this in real life. You know, when your landlord says, I'm going to sell this house so I cannot have you continue to stay here, or, you know, I'm going to have to end your lease because your rent is too low for me, they really don't have many options of where to go. So this is creating a massive displacement in low to middle income class folks. It's not even a low income limited issue anymore. It's hurting, you know, anybody who's not rich and doesn't have extra cash to go around to spend on housing.
Well, and let's talk about that minimum wage. We saw it go up this year, but like the cost of living increase that we get, it hasn't kept up with the pace of inflation since the 1950s. No. And so is a lot of this the result of the fact that we haven't kept pace with that inflation, and therefore people are struggling? They can't get over the hump because we just don't pay enough for a service job or for a job that we want in this country, but we're not willing to pay the amount so that person can really afford to live. And often they're working two or three jobs to do that.
Yeah. So when we talk about inflation, one thing to note right away is what drives inflation. And the current inflation we have right now is being driven by, first of all, energy prices, which are at the underlying layer of everything, right? Second is, though, price gouging both on housing and on the corporate side. We also need to stop the forces that are driving the inflation. So stabilizing housing prices, a factor of that. Because the main thing we want, if we want to do a holistic fix, is we also want to pay people what they deserve relative to cost of things. But generally, we also want their money to go further. The money that they already have, we want it to go further. And right now, it's not going anywhere close to basic needs. You know, the cost of living for a single parent in Ulster and Dutchess County is supposed to be closer to $40 an hour. And that is not where our minimum wage is. We are obviously also asking our upstate minimum wage to be in line with the downstate minimum wage, because it's not cheap to live in upstate New York anymore. But how do we make people's income go further? We need our schools to be properly funded. A lot of the expenses are coming out of, you know, people's property taxes that they cannot afford. We need the wealthier to take the share of funding things like schools.
Let me stop you right there, because this is going to be a big fight, the hold harmless.
Yes.
Identifying that there are some places, because the money comes out of the property tax, they're going to be more wealthy. Schools on Long Island, for example. But there are going to be other places in poor communities where there's no property tax base to fund that. And so you see where the inequity lies. We had lawsuits by the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. New York didn't follow the ruling. Then it tried to follow the ruling. Now we're looking at hold harmless, which would say, hey, there are these other districts that really need more, and you don't necessarily need to get more this year because you have enough. But I wonder if the funding of education, the formula is wrong to begin with, that we don't fund it out of the general fund and we rely on property taxes.
Ideally, we don't rely on property taxes because it creates inequity in schools, and because we don't want our public education to be ever feel so desperate to provide the services that they need. And in terms of stabilizing prices, really, people's income should not go primarily to just surviving. You know, somebody recently on Twitter said the expression cost of living is a strange expression because there's a cost attached to living. We don't want people to be ideally paying more than 25% of their income towards housing. We don't want people to be paying so much towards healthcare and still not get comprehensive coverage in return. And we don't want all of the basic needs to be out of reach for people. We need to invest in public education and good union jobs because those are opportunities for people. We need to invest in treatment. We need to make treatments more accessible because people need a system in which they can stabilize and really, you know, fulfill their actual potential. Right now, we are stunting people's potentials by putting them in dire situations.
We're speaking with Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha, a Democratic Socialist who represents the 103rd District in New York State. Yeah, education, healthcare, the climate, so that we can survive and mitigate the problems that we're experiencing right now with the storms and the flooding. The idea that if you were a CEO, we'll take a business model for a second, you would think and we haven't done this in many cases, you would value the worker the most because if they were well-educated and you kept them healthy with good health insurance, right, and you made sure that all the infrastructure around them was safe, boy, you might have a more efficient organization and it might even be more successful. But it seems like we go the other way, that the human being isn't valued as much as, you know, the profits that are going to be made, for example, for the shareholders that in this country are become more valued than the human being on the lower level.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall workers are seen as dispensable. And if they are kept feeling quite desperate, the assumption is the workers need the job more than the job needs workers. But, you know, we see this playing out very dangerously, especially in the field of care workers, whether it's hospital workers or home care workers or direct service providers. These are the folks that are really, really stretched, experiencing burnout. We don't have adequate staffing in our hospitals, people who need home care. But it's a very twisted logic to have an economy that deprioritizes people who do the most essential work, which is providing care. That has always been undermined, underpaid, but no robot is going to provide the kind of care that a nurse does when maybe the nurse holds your hand when you're going through something. And, you know, we see the intersection of everything. Speaking about people's money going further, I spoke to a few hospital workers recently, and what are the things that they deal with? Housing costs, childcare issues, it's all the same. And then I recently heard of somebody in my district saying that they have direct service providers who've had to sleep in their car. So people who need to do the work also don't have the housing and the stability that they need to be able to do the work. So why would they continue to do this demanding, stressful work when they can just take another retail job and that's going to pay the same and they will go home less mentally taxed and exhausted, you know? So it's all about prioritizing well-being and investing in those priorities.
Do you find, because you came to this country, what, in 2019 you became a citizen, is that right?
Yeah, but I came to the country in 2001.
Okay, 2001. Yeah. And immediately, I don't know if it was after 9/11, before 9/11.
It was 1 week before 9/11.
Wow. So yeah. You come here after seeing what happened in your country, you see that. Since then, we've seen January 6th. We've seen a move away from truth-telling in many cases and a need by the media to call out lies. And, you know, as someone who came from a country that had a democratic struggle, you must be keenly aware of what we're going through right now. What's your perspective on the state of democracy in the United States?
So here's the thing about democracy. It is an ancient idea, and it is our best idea. It's not perfect, but we're not going to be able to do better than democracy. The thing about democracy is that we will never get what everybody wants, but it is a site of struggle. It is a space of push and pull where our side of protecting the majority of people has to do constant work. It is sort of like cultivating democracy. And that means we don't just ask people to vote. We make them understand what is their power, what is their role in our political process. I run into a lot of people who want nothing to do with the political process, and that's a red flag for democracy because then erupts in situations like January 6th, where it can be instantly threatened and undermined in this chaos of suspicions and lies. When you have people who don't know what to believe and who don't know who to trust, that is a very dangerous situation for democracy. And that's another reason to bring people together, is because when people are cynical and tired, it's also our democracy that's getting tired, you know? So the health of our democracy depends on people believing in the process.
Faith in our institutions.
Yes.
And we seem to have lost faith in our politics, in law enforcement, in education, in our healthcare system, all the things that you and I were just talking about.
Yeah.
You can't have a society if you lose faith in your institutions. So when you look at this democracy, you see how fragile it is. And as we move toward this coming presidential election, I think you're right. It's hard to motivate people, though, when they've lost faith in something. And it'll be interesting to see in this presidential year how many turn out and how many sit on their hands.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, the average person is not keeping track of what benefit they're seeing from the local government versus the state government versus the federal government. They just need to feel their life improving, because if they feel that they have not been taken care of, they feel like, what's the point? And I've run into many of these folks. So that's really the responsibility we have in Albany. We have a state legislature with a Democratic supermajority, and we have the resources. And, you know, many of our local governments don't have the resources to significantly improve people's lives. So lots of people are depending on the New York State Legislature to not only deliver, but to lead by example what can be done. We cannot be falling behind Minnesota with their slim majority in terms of what people need to see in order to regain that faith in their democracy and their institutions.
All right, I have to play devil's advocate because I can hear the more conservative listeners, the Republicans, yelling at the radio, how are we going to pay for all this? It's bad enough. There's, what are they calling it? Out-migration to other states. We can't continue to give the people who have nothing more because, my goodness, people will leave the state.
So New York has 17,500 new millionaires. The people who are leaving in a higher number than the normal trend are households that were making $280,000 or less. So it's the people who cannot afford to live in New York that are leaving, especially Black and brown families. And then the data is out now on whether rich people moved out of New York State because of tax reform. And we see that, in fact, people have moved to other high tax states. And sometimes they've moved to second homes but have never left New York. The truth is that rich people don't make their decisions on saving pennies. They have enough money to live wherever they want and pay how much ever they want. Otherwise, they would not be spending $1,000 per champagne bottle. They left during the pandemic because New York was scary and people did not want to be in a big city. You know, a lot of New York City folks fled, and a lot of them
fled upstate.
Exactly. A lot of them actually tried to flee into our district. The housing demand was insane. I read an article where the broker said that they had fatigue from people reaching out, you know, with aggressive proposals to buy homes without seeing them, buying them with cash.
And pricing out the neighbors that are already living there as a result.
Yes, exactly. So the money is there. New York's economy right now is around $2 trillion. And the fact is, the economy has grown at a higher pace than our budget has. So you can actually see that as a cut. If the budget is not growing in pace with an economy, that's a cut. So I think there are easy ways to stress people out in terms of the revenues we might be losing with rich people leaving. But the revenues we are actually losing are the ones we are not collecting from the people who are already in the state, the very rich.
She is Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha, a Democratic Socialist who represents the 103rd District in New York State. Sarah Hanna, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Capital Connection, and I hope to talk to you again in the future.
Thank you so much.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustino. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.